Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 21 of Cryomos Tabletop Alchemy. It's good to be back. It's only been a week, but still, you know, I love dropping new episodes of the show. I actually really do. I like dropping new episodes of the show. It makes me feel really good and productive. All right. Top of the show, tip of the hat to my patrons for helping out on that end. Their support is super appreciated. And to all you listeners out there working on your hobby projects or stuck in traffic or cooking dinner or building IKEA furniture, whatever it is you're up to, I thank you all for hitting that follow button or that play button, and I hope you're getting something good out of this production. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I hope I'm putting something out there that's interesting for you to have on in the background while you're doing your thing. Okay, news. Nope, no news. Sometimes that's good news. No, wait. There is some news. My run on Paint All the Minis Paint Ramble podcast is in full swing, where Dan Adams and I continue to discuss his concept of sustainable gaming. So check out cryomo.com for links to those episodes if you're curious. And of course, you can find the Paint All the Minis podcast on most podcast apps. You can also join the Paint All the Minis Facebook group if you want to show off some of your own miniature painting or ask questions about miniature painting or get support for your hobby interests. The group is definitely for everyone from beginners to award-winning pros. Seriously, I mean, Vince Venturella drops pics of his minis on there. So drop by and say hi, and it's just a pretty cool community to, you know, hang out with about miniature painting if you are a Facebook kind of person. I know there's a lot of us out there that don't like to use Facebook, but it is, unfortunately, it's like one of the better places, I guess, to have these groups of that you can kind of, these digital groups, these digital meetups where you can get to know people of that have the same interests as you do. Anyway, also this week, completely not hobby related, but this week I directed a music video for my buddy who's produced the whole thing, and he's currently editing it. His name is Bradley Greenwell. He's one of my best friends, and he's an Emmy award-winning editor to boot. We worked on a one-day production for a Cold War Kids music video, and that one day beat the hell out of me because I'm old and I refuse for some reason to do exercise. I suppose it also speaks to the fact that work is kind of thin at the moment, so I'm out of shape. Yeah, so after what amounted to like a 16-hour day, we shot out 5 locations all around the downtown area in Riverside, California, including 3 hotels and a couple of exterior spots. I was completely wasted the next day and even part of the day after that. One of my other best friends, who I've actually interviewed for this podcast, but I haven't dropped that episode yet, his name is Bimal Karajia. He's just a fan of the band and asked if he could come and hang out on set. And Brad said, sure, but if you come, you got to work. And Bimal showed up, and I think he was there for about 2 minutes before he got drafted into driving talent around in his air-conditioned car and going to get lunch for the crew and holding bounce boards and the slate, and it was pretty funny. But all in all, everyone did an excellent job. Our DP, Jordi Ruiz-Masso, kicked some serious artistic ass. Our Steadicam operator, Scott Baker, was excellent. And our first AC, Patrick, did some focus-pulling sorcery that I just don't understand. And our star, Jade Catapretta, my apologies for probably totally mispronouncing her last name, she was a firecracker and really fun to work with, and just as an actress pulling more than her weight, she not only brought a bunch of energy and creative choices to the show, she rolled seamlessly with our tiny budget production and all the craziness that that sort of thing entails. And on top of all that, this was the first time I've gotten to shoot anything on the Alexa Mini. This is a digital cinema camera that shoots 4K video in a variety of formats, and it's been used to shoot projects like Game of Thrones, the German Netflix series Dark, the Disney movie Mary Poppins Returns, Green Book, all kinds of big-time productions. Anyway, so we shot a music video. I'm sure I'll send out a link to that when the final edit is done, but, you know, don't expect too much. It was just a laid-back sort of thing where it was hard work on the day, but we didn't work with any specific concept in mind. It was more of a, quote, here's an actress, here's a cool car, here are some hotel rooms, get some cool shots. One thing that's kind of interesting is this will mean very little to people that aren't in production work or film or video production, but, you know, nowadays video production becomes more and more accessible with the, you know, more affordable cameras, and cameras are getting smaller and smaller. I mean, you know, shooting on a Sony A7 III, which it's a super tiny little, it's just a regular little, you know, DSLR type camera. I mean, it's mirrorless, but whatever we call that. Well, I don't know. Anyway, but they're small. You get really good lenses for them. You know, you can shoot really, really cool looking stuff and stuff that's shot. It looks very pro. Lots of TV shows are shot on cameras like this. You know, the Canon cameras and the Panasonic photography cameras, all this stuff. And, you know, these cameras are very small and they're lightweight and you can move really quickly with them. But when you get a camera, like a cinema style package that you're shooting on set with, be it an Alexa Mini or a Red, I don't even know what Red's current, they change all their names so often with new units. I have no idea what it's called, but the smaller, like the tinier version of the larger red cameras, like the Alexa Mini is called the Alexa Mini because the regular Alexa camera from Arri, these cameras both come from Arri, which is spelled ARRI, and this is a fairly major regular high-end film production equipment manufacturer. They do a lot of film cameras and lighting and stuff like that. So the Alexa camera, you know, the Alexa or the big Reds, those are even bigger, and then the mini versions are little. So if you look at the Alexa Mini, the body of it, the core like sensor where you would attach lenses and stuff, it's just a little block. You know, it's probably about 6 inches by 6 inches by 6 inches. It's like this cube. And then you can, and it's heavy though. I mean, it weighs a lot more than an equivalent camera of that size would weigh. And of course you put on cinema lenses and then you have to have, you know, a shoulder rig and you have to have recording, you know, media recording units. You have to have an LCD screen. You got an eyepiece. So you rig out all this stuff and the camera weighs, it is not light. Like you put this thing on your shoulder and it's like, yeah, man, this is like a 20-pound rock sitting on your shoulder. So, and then you need a first AC. You need someone to pull focus because it's very difficult to pull focus when you're operating the camera, which is why on most movie productions, you know, a camera crew is not just one person. It's not like videography. It's a crew of usually three people minimum to run one of these cameras, but it's definitely two people absolute minimum because you need a focus puller 99.9% of the time. And the focus puller is pulling focus while the camera operator is framing up shots and moving the camera and everything like that. And then we had a Steadicam, and Steadicam operator is doing his thing, but he can't pull focus, you know, while he's Steadicamming. So then focus puller's using a remote, like a remote screen to watch the image. And he's got a remote dial that he can manipulate that rolls the focus on the lens itself. So all of a sudden where you had one person on a videography shoot, you know, like a lot of things that I would do, you know, I'll go out and shoot, I'll do a one man band sort of interview and B roll kind of shoot. If I go out and shoot a corporate video, like I'm going to go and interview, say a lawyer, I'll interview him in his office. I set up the camera, I set up the lights, and then we shoot an interview. You know, I set up the microphone. I can do all that stuff myself. It's very simple. And, I mean, it's helpful if I have somebody along with me, but most of these jobs are fairly low paying. So it's just me, one man band. It's a lot of videographers do. You know, you shoot an interview and then you go get some B roll, you grab your little camera, you go handheld, put it in slow motion, you know, get some image stabilizer in there and you start shooting and you get up all these little pieces of B roll and you use that to do the edit. You go home, you do the edit and you deliver the video. But when you come out with this Alexa Mini on set, you've got, you know, two people plus a Steadicam operator, and it's like just to move the camera from point A to point B. Like, hey, let's get this shot over here. Okay, hang on, let me pick up this 25-pound brick. Let me carry it over here. Let me get the other guy with the monitor, move this over here. So already, hopefully you can see like the difference in time, what goes on when you introduce this more cinematic camera system versus this little run-and-gun, you know, pocket-sized camera that one person can operate. So it's a very big difference in time and how much, you know, how much you're expending in time and crew to put a production to have a production use one of these cinema grade cameras. So there's all that going on. So anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. That's just another awesome little incoherent ramble that I went on sideways. Apologies. Let's move on to some sundries. All right, Tabletop Alchemy is available on most popular podcast apps, and as much as it doesn't seem like it, this is a podcast about lots of things tabletop-oriented, such as Dungeons & Dragons, Warhammer, skirmish games, miniatures, miniature painting, terrain crafting and and fantasy artwork in general. So you can find all the episodes and show notes at crimemode.com, and you can find links to all my social media there as well. And of course, you can stream the video version of this podcast on YouTube, where each episode is accompanied by footage of whatever I might have worked on at the paint desk recently. If you'd like to support the show somehow, one of the best ways is just by dropping a comment or a rating on whatever app you listen to the show on, or sending a link to an episode you dig to someone else you know who might like it as well. Now, here's something a little bit interesting. When you set up a Patreon account, Patreon suggests you create a minimum of 3 financial goals. And these sort of like appear on the page as like financial goals, like, hey, when you hit this financial goal, this sort of thing will happen. And since I was just making the Patreon as kind of a lark when I first set up this whole thing, I mean, it's super appreciative now. And actually, I see going forward with the potential lack of my day job kind of work coming in, Patreon starting to look, it looks very, very nice every month when I see that come in. It's very helpful. And but yeah, since I kind of was setting it up when I decided to do this podcast, I was just setting it up as sort of, cause I thought that's what, you know, most podcasts and things like this of this nature sort of set up a Patreon to offer a little bit of extra things and give people a way to support the show financially if they are so inclined. So when I first set it up, I put up some pretty random benchmarks cause I really didn't have any, I didn't think it would really go anywhere. So these are very much what one might call pie in the sky sorts of goals. And I just realized that we are now halfway to the first goal, which is, to be frank, kind of surprising and very cool. So that first goal states that if I ever hit $100 per month, I'll do a live stream once a month on YouTube or Twitch. So who knows? Maybe that will become a thing in the near future. All right, let's get into it. This episode, I go down under one more time. This week, to have a conversation with a guy who is a bona fide adventurer. He might dispute that. And he's a bona fide artist. He goes by the Instagram handle, The Real Broken Fingers. And yeah, that name ain't facetious. His work on Instagram is Warhammer 40K oriented, and he creates massive dioramas. You gotta see him to believe him. So head on over to Instagram and check out his feed. He goes out of his way to evoke the gothic, grim, dark atmosphere of Space Marines in their eternally war-torn environment. And on top of his excellent paintwork and terrain model making, his photography is fantastic as well. So in our conversation, we talk about straight up sailing the high seas, broken appendages, cinematic photography, world building with models, chiaroscuro, coffee table books, and of course, fabricating, painting, and displaying amazing dioramas. When I asked him if he'd be down for an interview / chat about art and models and stuff, I was unaware that he had just appeared on another podcast. A much, much bigger podcast. Much bigger. That podcast is called The Independent Characters, and it's a huge Warhammer podcast that is really good if you're into all things Warhammer related. I'll link to Jeremy's episode on that show. I believe it's episode 190, and there's also a timestamp to find the point where he comes online. I will say that we got to chat a bit longer than he did on the other podcast, so there's definitely some added value to checking out our conversation here. He's got some great stories and some great words of wisdom, and it's a super fun chat, so let's toss an anchor and float a while. I'm sure that's all nautical nonsense, but I'm Cryomo, so there. I did listen to the podcast, to the Independent Characters, and I have to thank you for introducing me to the Independent Characters. I'd never heard of their podcast, which I know is kind of dumb because they're kind of big. But yeah, they're pretty rad. It's a pretty rad podcast.
So, yeah, I really like it. I really like it. It's good.
All right. So I don't want to cover, I'm going to try not to double up on you too much for the information you put there. Of course, I'll put a link to that podcast in the show notes for this one. And okay. So I've got some questions, and of course, you know, it's laid back. If we can just chat about whatever, and if there's anything you don't want to talk about or something you want to bring up that I don't mention, please feel free to bring it up. Let's start off first with just an introduction. Can you just introduce yourself, tell us who you are, and just a brief bit of background about who you are, maybe what your day job is?
Yep, no worries. So my name's Jeremy. I am based in Sydney, and I'm a professional yacht captain, which I've been doing now for 15 years, maybe a bit more. During the day, I manage large luxury cruising vessels for for private owners and also for, you know, corporate staff and charters and that sort of thing. When I finished high school, I went to university and studied fine arts, where I majored in painting and drawing. Graduated from there in 2001. And yeah, I've been drawing and painting all my life, whether it's Berlin, you know, models or landscapes, or, you know, I'd sort of draw quite surreal seascapes and things like that.
So there's all kinds of stuff I want to, there's all kind of tangents I want to jump on already. Yeah, so yeah, some of my questions were like, I was curious if you had been drawing all your life or doing art and stuff. So what was, what was your inspirations and what were you into, like before you got into high school or even through high school or that kind of age range before you went to art school and stuff?
I was typical young kid in the 80s. I was into, you know, action movies and Predator and Alien.
Nice.
All those like classic sci-fi movies. My auntie actually got me into Star Trek when I was a young kid. I was comic books, got into heavy metal in high school, and just I really liked the art and the way that all of that music was put together and produced, and the way that it had a sort of real character to it that really appealed to me. It's sort of what appeals to me about the Warhammer universe, is that that sort of really quite grim aesthetic. It's a nice escape.
Yeah. The grim aesthetic is a nice escape, because when you look at the worlds that you build, it does not look like someplace you'd want to go into.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
That's awesome, man. All right. So, okay, here, I got a couple questions I like to ask people before we get into sort of the nitty gritty of the actual artwork and stuff, just to sort of get some background on you as a person and stuff. First off, can you explain to me or explain to us the origin of your Instagram handle, your name, The Real Broken Fingers?
So would have been in 2006. I was captain of a sailing boat in the Greek islands, and I got my right ring finger stuck in a spinnaker halyard, which is a rope that pulls up a large sail at the front of the boat, and there's a lot of force on it, and it went up and I went down, and it gave me what they call a compound spiral fracture. And I was about a 12-hour motor from the nearest port, so we motored there, I drove us there, and then I had to go and negotiate the Greek language and the Greek medical system and all of that stuff. And so I had that name, and then I don't know, I had a few ideas for names for my Instagram and they were all taken, so I just went with that, and I didn't really think that it would become a thing. I just had the Instagram so I could look at other people's cool stuff, and then I started posting stuff, and yeah, I don't know, there's not really anything particularly meaningful about it, other than that I busted my finger pretty badly a few years ago.
That's good enough, man. I mean, the important part of that is not that you busted your finger. I mean, that's the hard part. The best part about it is that you had to drive yourself in the yacht to the hospital.
Well, that's it. I also then had to hire a Jeep to drive up the top of a mountain once we got to the port.
Oh, dude, so you're straight up like a straight up modern day adventurer, man.
It's not that bad. I was in like the Greek islands. It's pretty luxury, but it was one of the smaller ones. So I had to.
Don't ruin the story, man. Come on. Just say.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, there were pirates and, there was all kinds of stuff.
That's it.
Dude, so yeah, I mean, I do have to ask about the yacht captaining thing. Just the idea of, you must enjoy doing that since you've done it for so long, right?
Oh yeah, you've got it. If you didn't enjoy it, you wouldn't do it. It's it sounds very glamorous, but the reality is less glamorous.
Nice way to put it. All right, that's super cool, man. So, what are some of your? We already kind of mentioned some of your favorite movies from the 80s and stuff, and what you're in. But currently today, what are some of your favorite movies or TV shows? Or do you even watch movies and TV shows?
That's a tough one. Yeah, look, I I have two children. So I have a 5-year old and a 2-year old. And basically, I get home from work and I do the bedtime and the dinner and all of that chaos that anyone with kids knows about. And then my wife and I watch the news and she goes upstairs to bed and I go into the studio and paint creepy toy soldiers and listen to lore videos on YouTube. And, you know, that's my thing at the moment.
I got it, man.
I really haven't seen a lot of movies. What was the last movie I saw?
It's totally fine, man. I totally understand that entire scenario. I realize I have to come back in about 10 years and we'll ask that question again. Then you'll be able to, you'll be able to watch some movies then.
Yeah, we'll see how we go then. If I can, I listen to, on YouTube, I listen to a lot of Luton, who does the Warhammer lore videos, and I think that guy's awesome. I really like the Oculus Imperialis guy on YouTube. He's awesome. Listen to podcasts, that sort of stuff.
And just to clarify, like, I know some of this information from the other podcast appearance that you were on. So, but to clarify for the audience here that maybe hasn't heard that yet, you actually don't play these games, right?
That's right. Yeah. I had HeroQuest when I was a kid and I played HeroQuest when I was a little kid, but I've never played a game of Warhammer or like the tabletop game. I've played, you know, the board game. Yeah.
I think it's pretty fantastic actually, because you're in it purely for the lore and the model making side of it, which is a very interesting side of it. I think it's pretty rad. Do you actually have any desire at all to one day play a game of Warhammer, or is you just like, nah, I'm this is not your thing, the tabletop gaming?
I totally would. I think it's a sort of game that I wouldn't see myself ever going into a store and playing it with a whole lot of people I don't really know, with, you know, probably not painted models and on scenery that I didn't make. If I had some mates that were like that were keen to play the game, learn how to play the game, had the time to learn how to play the game, yeah, I would probably get into it. But as it stands, I have so little time to, you know, for extra hobbies. Like, this is the painting takes up 100% of my spare time. But I would genuinely like to get into it.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool. That's, yeah, you got, it gives you something to look forward to, you know, when the kiddos grow up, and then you'll be like, okay, I've got some time now that I'm, you know, getting old. You'll have some time to get into it.
Yeah.
By the time you're like, I can't, you know, physically build these large dioramas anymore, now I'm ready to play the game. It'll be good. All right. So can you tell me about one life event that you would classify as either the most exciting or the most impactful, or just something amazing or strange that you went through, not counting the birth of your children?
Not counting the birth of my children.
Because obviously I know the impact of that, but yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's pretty big. That's pretty big. There's been a few, but a lot of bad sailing stories. Okay, so there was one where we were coming back from Hobart to Sydney instead of Sydney to Hobart. I'm sure a lot of people know about the famous yacht race. So basically, it's a pretty treacherous crossing of Bass Strait. There, I was racing. I wasn't racing the boat, but I was leaving Hobart after my guests got off, and I had to be back in Sydney 3.5 days later to get on a flight and go to Fiji to be the best man at my best mate's wedding. The weather was marginal, but I thought, oh, we can get in front of it, which was my first mistake. Went out, got about 100 miles south of a place called Eden, which is the middle of this Bass Strait, which is a pretty appalling bit of water. And we were going all right. You know, we had three of us on board, and we ended up taking a whole lot of water into the bow of the boat. The anchor let go in the middle of the Bass Strait, which is not a good thing. We ended up flooding a good portion of the boat, which was about, I guess we probably took on a ton and a half of water. So we were bailing it out, just the three of us with buckets, for 10 hours. It was pretty ugly conditions. I guess the seas were, according to the Weather Bureau, they were between 9 and 10 meters seas. So it was a pretty big sea and it was very windy.
I'm getting all freaked out just sitting in my desk chair thinking about this, man.
It was all right. You sort of go into, you know, all your training and all the processes that you do. And I luckily had a one of the guys that was on board was a personal trainer for the Royal Marines. So he could have bailed for another 10 hours and quite enjoyed it. Yeah, so we ended up getting, we got a rescue pump dropped to us out of a plane, and the Navy came. It was all pretty exciting, but we managed to, you know, we sorted all the problems out, took the boat back into port, checked everything over, and then sailed back. And I actually made the flight for the wedding. You know, it was all good. And it was the point where I realized that I don't panic when I, you know, when the shit hits the fan, I'm okay. I can deal with it. If something goes wrong, I can sort it out. It was pretty terrifying, but I also came out of it knowing that, yeah, look, if I'm called upon to make life and death decisions, I can do it. So yeah, that was good. That was what I took away from it.
That's an incredible way to end that story. That's very cool, man. Whew, that's gnarly, but that's a valuable thing to learn about yourself, right? That's very good.
It is a very valuable thing to learn about yourself.
So now I understand that you would actually survive just fine inside of one of your dioramas.
Well, I don't know. I really don't know.
You give it a good shot anyway.
Yeah, I give it a good shot as long as there was a boat, you know. Yeah. I'm good at what I know.
Excellent.
I'm not a great runner.
Okay, so I'm gonna get into some specific stuff about this hobby and all this stuff and art school and everything, right? So okay, so obviously you're into a lot of the lore for Warhammer, and I assume you've read a lot of the Black Library books.
I do, yeah.
Who are some of your favorite authors from the Black Library, or do you have any favorite particular editions or novels that you're like, no, these are a couple of my favorite titles from the Black Library?
Look, anything by Aaron Dembski Bowden is probably my favorite. I loved Betrayer was awesome. The First Heretic was just so good. The Talon of Horus and Black Legion are just amazing books. Obviously all the Eisenhorns are great. That was one of the first ones I read. I really loved the first three or four books of the Horus Heresy is what actually got me into, it sort of kicked me into going out and buying a model kit and seeing what I could do with it. So those first three books were amazing.
How did you actually first get one in your hands? Like, what set of circumstances brought you to the point where you had one of those books in your hands?
So I was reading, I think it's the third one in that opening trilogy where Loken's holding the breach in the downed starship on Davin, and he's getting attacked by all the plague zombies. And I just had this really clear mental picture of it. Like I pictured on it there. That's really cool. And I thought I could build something like that, because you know, from a display perspective, if you're displaying something, you want to see each and every model coming down a pile of rubble is a great way to do that. It also gives you a sense of the scale of the universe that Warhammer is set in. It's just this, everything is just cranked up to 11. Starships are 12 kilometers long and they're 5 kilometers high, and you know, and I got this clear picture from that, and that sort of led me to think about doing it. And then I was just going on going on Google Images and Pinterest. I didn't have Instagram at that stage, I don't think. I was looking at a lot of the Iron Sleet guys. Migs from Iron Sleet, I saw his Space Wolves that he'd done, the True Scaled Space Wolves that he'd done years ago, I think they are. I just thought, wow, that is awesome. That is how I pictured it. You know, like I obviously wasn't ready to just start kit bashing things and true scaling models. So I thought I'll build this one model and see how I go. And that was the start of it. I went into the local Warhammer store and discovered to my shock how expensive everything was.
Oh, sure.
The guy gave me the box. I was like, what? That's what? $60.
Define the term true scaling, just for anyone who doesn't know or what that is exactly.
basically, the old Marines were, their torso is in scale to human scale. So a human should be about 7 human heads high. And that looks about right. Some people are obviously more, some people are less. An Astartes should be more because their head is should be smaller than their body proportionately because their head has stayed the same size while their bones have grown, their muscles have grown. As they've gotten older, they've gotten even bigger. Yet the models, the standard models, that pre-Primaris, obviously, used to have very small legs. The legs just, they don't look right. They look really wrong. And true scaling is using, there's a number of different things you can do, but basically fixing that. You can either cut the legs and insert spacers or use Terminator legs that you fill in with green stuff. There's a few different ways to fix it. But yeah, true scaling is just that idea of fixing it.
I was going to ask, again, I got split tangents here to go on. But
that's all right.
So before we get too far away from the art school thing, so I'm curious, first off, when did you find the Black Library stuff? Did you start reading or getting into Warhammer before you were in art school or after you were out of art school or during art school?
No. Well and truly after. So I finished art school in 2001 and I hadn't picked up any, you know, miniatures or anything since I was 10. So since HeroQuest came out and I painted some of those very badly, which I'm actually... I'm working on repainting them. I actually dug them out of my parents' garage.
Oh, wow.
So they're getting repainted, which is a separate, whole separate account that I've got on Instagram, but we'll leave that. After that, yeah, I didn't touch them until 2016, it would have been. So that was my first sort of set of Warhammer thing.
So what made you actually get back into it?
Pick up the book?
Yeah.
What I'd done, I had read, I played that the Space Marine video game, the Xbox game.
Oh, the video game, right, okay.
Yeah, that was so good. Just running around in that and looking at the environments and the, not so much, the game was great fun, but the setting was what I was interested in. I was really interested in like how these guys were built, how these Astartes were genetically forged into these transhuman killing machines. And I started just sort of looking at like the Wikipedia, not Wikipedia, you know, the Warhammer wikis and that sort of stuff.
Sure, yeah.
And listening to lore videos on YouTube. And I thought, I may as well just go and pick up one of the books and see how it is. And I sort of expected it to be a bit, I don't know what the word would be, sort of bolter porn, I guess they'd call it, you know, where it's just basically an ad for the game. The first thing I read was Horus Rising, and it was completely not what I expected at all. It's really well written, and it was a great story, and it was relatable, and I thought, yeah, this is great. That was what did it.
Yeah, and you're always going to, like, you're interested in the lore, and how you said in the game you got interested in the ambiance and the environment, and how you're putting your miniatures. It's you know, they're always surrounded by this environment that you're building as well. The environment is just as important, you know, with the miniatures, you know. So you're always world building with the stuff that I see on your Instagram.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. Yeah, that's what I do. Every Monday, I have Mondays off, right? So I look after the kids on Monday while my wife works. Generally, when they're asleep and at kindy and whatever, I'll go out and I'll get a day where I can take photos, like, you know, daylight. So they're all just done in natural, indirect daylight. So Monday, I'll go out and I'll take a whole heap of photos of old models, new models, and just experiment with the photography side of it. And that, like you say, that world building side of it, that trying to place them in a setting and give them a frame of reference, because I think that the models themselves, especially if you convert them and kit bash them and you spend so long making them, you should spend just as long giving them context. And the more context they have, the scarier they are, I think. The more removed from your own reality they become. And that's what's interesting about the whole thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was going to, this is, I have questions here about photography towards the end of the thing, but I'll get into it now. But so, I mean, you have a really good, you have a very cinematic eye, and I shoot video for a living, and I really appreciate your framing and the way that you stage the photographs. And I'm curious about, well, you already said you put them in daylight. That's surprising to me too. I thought it was maybe you would light them sort of studio style, but daylight is awesome. And also I'm curious, like how much, or do they always have practical backgrounds, or do you sometimes do any sort of matte painting as a background?
No, always physical. And it's always just a piece of cardboard, different colored cardboard. So it's either black, light gray, blue. I've got a yellow piece, a pink piece, and then I've done a quick acrylic sort of smoky, dusty war zone sort of backdrop, which will be actually stuck onto the back of the large piece that I'm working on at the moment. But it's all physical, and there's no lighting. There's nothing really done in post-production other than I take all the photos on my, it's a 2-year-old iPhone. I've got the Mac or whatever it comes with, iPhoto. Sometimes I will adjust the exposure on that. So if they're a little bit dark, I'll adjust the exposure. And a couple of them, I've got this free app. I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but it was just a free app. And sometimes I'll add like a lens flare or something for a bit of extra fun, but that's all it does really. It'll just add like a lens flare or a sort of ray of sunshine or something. But yeah, apart from that, the rest of them, so I reckon 99% of the ones that you'll see on my Instagram account are physical backgrounds, natural indirect daylight or direct daylight sometimes. They're pretty simple to photograph, I find.
Right. People are going to hate when you say that.
Well, it's where you do it as well. So you can't just have natural indirect daylight, stick it next to your window and it'll work. You need to be able to shield it. So, you know, you can use bits of paper, you could use a blind that you can open and close. It's just about controlling the level of that light. So how strong it is, what angle it's coming from. The more you can control, the easier it is. Initially, when I first started trying to photograph them, I was doing it at night, just under, you know, lamps that I could sort of move around, and it would take forever to position it right so that you could see the paint job and there weren't shadows and it looked sort of natural or it looked cool. And it would take me, you know, I'd take 100 photos right. on the phone.
Right. Yeah.
But now it's like bing, bang, boom, done.
One of my favorite photographs of yours is, it's basically these two Marines. They're on like an upper level of a destroyed building. They're like inside of a room, but of course there's no wall. Like the walls are torn out.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I know the one. They're in a they're in a destroyed room, and there's a guy with a sniper rifle and a guy with a shotgun.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's just they're just staged so well. It's very. It looks like action is happening. They almost look like you can feel the motion, and you're kind of low, you know, the camera angle's kind of low looking up, and it's really cool. All your photos are very cool.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that's the thing as well. I think that's really important to the sort of where you're viewing them from.
Mm-hmm.
It creates that sense of it's a world, it's a place. I see a lot of people will paint these amazing models, and then I'll just sort of stick them on the desk and take the photo. But that's not how they would look if you saw one of these, some creepy mechanical servitor or something, they wouldn't be at, you know, you wouldn't be above them. You'd be right below them running. Yes.
Running. Or, they'd be behind you and they'd be shaky cam.
Yeah, that's it. So trying to use, you know, what you see in films or, you know, I get a lot of inspiration from Time magazine photos of war zones and things. You get a lot of reference photos from that. Not inspiration, that's the wrong word, but as reference photos, that's what I sort of use.
Yeah, there's actually, I'm looking, I was just scrolling through your feed while we chat, and there's two photos I'm going to direct people to go check out, like to actually look at them side by side, and it evokes exactly what you're talking about, because the two photos are of the same model. They're the same diorama. It's a very small, it's a single figure. It's the guy with the, he's got the shield with like sort of the sideways V on the shield, and he's got the big blue sword.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So you have two photos. One photo is like a normal photo where it's sort of wide, you're up a little high, you can see the whole diorama, the platform and everything. And so it's like a normal model. It's like a picture somebody would take of a model, you know, at like a show on a table, right? There it is.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the next shot next to it is the one where you position the camera lower. He's looking right at camera and it's really cool. It's like a movie poster. It's awesome.
Yeah. It adds character. Yeah. It adds character.
And of course it helps that the guy is painted like super well. Like it's just wonderful. Your paintwork, all that stuff. It's super great.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think also a lot of people paint a lot better than I do, obviously. A lot of people say, yeah, how do you, I don't know. I think it is the photography. I think it's more, I'm having trouble trying to describe it. I think it's the camera angle is so important.
A lot of the shots that you take are very unique in that perspective. I think some of it too is the fact that some of your dioramas, they're so vertical, right? So you really do have this opportunity to get lower. A lot of people don't have that, you know, they just don't have that. They're not building the same kind of a thing. Where do you go, or where do you like to go nowadays for inspiration or reference, or, you know, just sort of filling your creative well for this sort of grim, dark aesthetic? And are there particular things that you look at nowadays where you go, or do you just kind of go straight to Instagram and follow a couple hashtags or look up John Blanchard or whatever? Like, what do you like to do?
So Pinterest, really, I'll use Pinterest to not to look at models that people have made, but to look at cool photos, reference photos, really. So if I want to see what a destroyed building looks, what a destroyed building really looks like, not how one is painted. So for a good example is I've been looking for this model that I'm making now with the Warhound Titan. I want to use a military modeler's sort of level of detail, level of weathering and environment. And if you go and look at pictures of destroyed buildings that have been actually destroyed in Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan, there's not a million colors. There's not tarpaulins and there's not jerry cans. And it's all one color. It's all dust. If a building falls down, everything is covered in dust. And that also that bit in Betrayer where Aaron Dembski Bowden's describing the World Eaters battle, and he said that you can't see anything, even from orbit. It is just dust. There's just nothing but dust. And so I'll get inspiration from something like that in the book, and I'll think, yeah, that's it. And then I will go to something like Pinterest or Google Images, and I will type in, you know, a whole lot of different stuff, and I'll say, okay, that's what that looks like in real life. You obviously have to ramp it up and put some details in there, but yeah. That's what I'll use Pinterest for. Instagram, the models, really, what other people are making. I'll have a look and I'll see what they're doing on Instagram. And the community on there is really good. There's not a whole lot of, I don't know, whinging and whining and, oh, God, I can't believe they've done this and they've done that. And, you know, it doesn't have a lot of that. Also, reading. And I also get a lot of inspiration from old paintings. So I did a model which is the forge ship for the Titan Legion that I'm building. And I think it's on my feed from, I don't know, a couple of months ago, I guess. I was looking at a lot of classic Dutch sort of paintings, which use light to, it's hotspot. I forget the exact word for it now, where you have areas of light and dark and it really highlights certain aspects of it.
Chiaroscuro?
I don't know how to pronounce it, so I'll let you do that.
Yeah, chiaroscuro. Yeah, it's very using shadow, heavy shadows and
heavy shadows. To really create drama. And so that whole piece was inspired by that picture frame that I had lugged all over Europe like an idiot and not used for 10 years. I had this frame. It made me think of those old paintings, and I was looking at the old paintings, and then that led to an idea. So yeah, it's not purely Instagram or the computer or the phone. It's, you know, it's pictures and ideas and stuff that I've got lying around the house, and I'll think, oh, That could be cool. Yeah, so the Space Wolves, big Space Wolves diorama I did, I bought a glass cabinet and I wanted to fill it. And I thought, oh, it looks boring just having the shelves. So I removed the shelves and filled the whole cabinet.
And that's how you came up with the idea to do this. How tall is that diorama?
It's big. It's, I think from memory, it's 1.6 meters, something like that. It's a whole detolf from top to bottom. There's right. like a millimeter at the top.
That's big. That's awesome. Yes, that's incredible. That's very, very cool. Okay, so let me jump into some technical questions about model making here for you. Just some little detail things I wanted to ask. So in one of your posts, I noticed that you stated that the Winsor Newton size 1 brush is the only brush you use. Is that truly the case?
That is 100% the case. I have one that is beat to hell that I use for bigger things. And then I have one that is in really good condition that I look after, and that's it.
Wow.
Everyone's different, but you don't need, if you've got a nice tip on the brush, it's already as small as you're going to get. If you get a 000, it's going to have one hair at the end if it's perfectly, if it's perfectly maintained. If you've got a size 1 or a 2 even, it's going to have one hair at the end that's perfectly maintained, but the body of it holds a lot more moisture, holds a lot more water, a lot more paint. It stays wet. It doesn't dry as quickly. And yeah, I use that for everything.
Wow. And do you use an airbrush as well for any of your stuff?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. I do use an airbrush. I am only just now starting to get comfortable with the airbrush. It really purely was a means of base coating. Until recently, I've worked it out. I don't have a great airbrush, and there's not really a lot of stores in Sydney that sell them. And I was sort of reluctant to go online and spend hundreds of dollars on something I can't pick up and hold because I'm old.
Right. I get that. You want to see the goods, man. Let me make sure it's cool.
That's it.
So there's I want to bring this up real quick. There's an example of the, you do these tutorials, you put up these little tutorials that are self-contained on Instagram. So it'll be a series of pictures that show some, how to do something. The one that I really, really like is the one you did with the eyes, which was a face tutorial, and you started with the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
That was what it was.
Yeah.
Just for me personally, dude, I thought I wanted to thank you for that one, because the fact that you started with the eyes on, it was primer. And then you started with the whites of the eyes. And I was like, oh my goodness, I've never considered doing that. I always do the eyes last. In fact, I always do the eyes. If I do them at all, I do them at the very end because I'm so terrified of messing something up.
But by the end, your paint's finished around the eyes. You've got all those layers on. If you don't get it right, you're going to add more and more paint. Do it at the beginning. Nail it at the beginning and go into the rest happy,
Yeah, absolutely, man. I saw that and I was like, I can do that. And that will, just seeing that, I was like, oh, all of a sudden I feel less stressed about painting certain things, man. It was very cool. Can I ask you, why do you, I don't mean this in like the way that it sounds tonally, but why, what makes you, why do you do these little tutorials and throw them up for people? Like what makes you take the time and put this stuff together?
So I take photos all through the process. I'll take photos so that because I don't get a lot of time to actually do these things. I do an hour a night on average, and that's all I do. There's nothing else, but I'll take photos, and then during the day, if I've got a spare couple of minutes, I'll look at those photos, and I can decide when I get in front of the paints tonight, this is the first thing I need to do, this is the second thing I need to fix, then I need to do this, then I need to do that. I sit down and I hit the table running. I know exactly the order that everything needs to happen in. I'm not thinking. I'm just doing. When I get there, it maximizes my time. I get asked a lot of questions. Like, people will message me and they'll say, how do you do this? How do you do that? I'm answering those questions so often, and I'm taking the photos anyway. I may as well just skip the middleman and just post the tutorial. I'm not interested in trying to monetize my hobby time. And, you know, more power to people that can make money out of Patreon or anything like that. That's cool. It's just not for me. I don't really think that what I'm telling people is particularly groundbreaking. They're just, you know, little tips. I would honestly feel bad charging for it. So I may as well just, you know.
Well, it's super cool, man. I'm sure it's much appreciated by people out there. It's very cool. All right, man. So let me ask you about detail. So, yeah. I mean, we could pick up any of these photos and point out all the level of detail that you get into and stuff. One of my favorite pieces that you've done is the Shipmaster, I think it's called. Right, the crazy robot.
I like him.
Oh, yeah. That thing is super cool. But just in general, right, the detail in your work is fairly exquisite, and it's there's a lot of it. And can you talk a little bit about just about how and why you pursue the level of detail, like the little tiny nernies and the piping and the wiring, and it's like everything, it's like you keep adding more and more stuff, little things. And I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about what makes you pursue that level of detail.
So what I used to have a, when I was at university, I had a lecturer who I used to, that's how my drawings, if I do a drawing, it'll be large, like I do large pen and ink or pencil drawings. And I mean, I've done one that's 6 meters long, 1.8 meters high, and it has, you know, individual hairs in eyebrows in it. And what my university lecturer used to say was these little things are rewards for looking. If you're looking at something and you're taking the time to really go further and further and see not just the big picture, but go right into it, you are rewarded with these little rewards, little things that you wouldn't notice at first. And I just think that's cool. And the details are there. And I'm also quite anal. So if the details are there, I'm painting them. You buy these models and they're not cheap and they take a long time to build and all of that. You may as well get the practice, paint every single possible thing.
You apply that same level of attention to detail to actual scratch building as well, right? I mean, it's like,
everything.
So when you're building something, that's not something that already exists that you purchased that had detail on it. That's you put that detail in there.
Yeah. So I get like copper wire, I guess it's like electrical wire, you know, like if you're wiring up a stereo or something, you get that and you strip it down and the tiny little wires that are inside that big strip, those individual strands, I like chucking those in, and then you paint them with a, you know, a nice hazard stripe.
Yes.
That sort of thing.
You and the hazard stripes, man, and the checkerboard. I was going to ask a question about that, but I'm not, about technique, but I'll ask it really quick.
Yeah.
Do you have any, there's two things I was going to ask you about as far as techniques go. One is about the checkerboarding and the striping, and that's like a common thing that a lot of people kind of, you know, they will encounter at some point that they want to do that to a model. Do you have any quick tips on how you do that to make it any easier, or something people should, you know, like give them some advice, like, hey, if you're going to try this, make sure you don't do this or do this. This helps make it easy.
Some of it I do freehand, some of it I don't. So a lot of the stuff, if you look at my black shields on Instagram, they've got a half red, it's a skull, and then the other half of the, you know, shoulder pad or tilting shield or whatever it is red with white checks. And those white checks are just the transfer that comes in the transfer kit from, I think it's from the, just any of the intercessor kits now have those checks, and you use Microsol and Microset and you just bend them to the right shape, and that's the easiest way to get the checks. But if you, a lot of them obviously you can't get checks like that, so the robes, I find that you can't really put them on robes because they're not long enough, so all of the robes that are on my Mechanicum stuff are all free-handed. So the key with doing the checks is I do the black robe and then I do the white. So I'll do the band and the band will be the thickness of the band will be a brush thickness, and then so two checks, and then get a lot of water in your brush, a lot of thin paint, and then you just very, very carefully and slowly and hold your breath, and you just make a grid and color it in. There's no real There's no real hack for it. It's just right. Spend the time, hold your breath when you do it. Try not to think of what you're doing. Just think of each individual brush stroke. Position the model so that you're always moving down. If you're doing freehand, if you're trying to make a straight line, it needs to go down. So if you're going across the model, you're not going to, it's an uphill battle. It's not going to work. If you want to do a line, a straight line, do it downhill, do it vertical. And yeah, then it's just practice.
That's a good tip, man. I mean, the idea that it's that doing vertical lines is easier than doing horizontal lines.
Yeah.
That's a good tip.
Top to bottom. Yeah. Go top to bottom.
And I know we're always looking for that magic, you know, the magic pill to make something super easy. And the answer always comes down to, nah, it's just practice.
Yeah, unfortunately.
It's okay, though. But that's pretty cool, though. You've done a bunch, you've done a few models that have a yellow, right, as their main color. Yellow is traditionally notoriously difficult to paint, right? I mean, as far as like, it always goes on, you know, it's too transparent. It seems difficult to work with. Do you find it difficult to work with, or do you just apply it like normal? Do you apply it over a white base coat, or do you just have any issue with it at all?
Look, it is, paint is paint. It's the same. It's all the same. It's some of it is thicker and thinner, and I use an airbrush to do the yellow, which is the way to do it. I think if you're trying to do large flat panels without an airbrush and they're yellow, it's instantly going to be harder because it is a very transparent color. It's obviously something to do with the pigment. It is a very transparent color and you'll always get brush strokes. It'll always be difficult. If you get that base coat down airbrushed on a large panel on things like tubes and pipes, it's easy. But yeah, if you're doing an Imperial Fist or something, you want to get that smooth. Yeah. I really think either the airbrush or those cans of yellow paint. It's all about the shading with yellow. So if you want a bright yellow, you shade up. So you highlight brighter. And if you want a dark yellow, a sort of more grimy yellow, my ones are Cassandori yellow from the Citadel range, and then the orange. I've forgotten the name of the orange shade. It is Fugan. Fugan orange. That again is really simple. So I'll get the thing base coated in yellow and then shade down from there. So it'll be a bit of Cassandori yellow at the bottoms of the panels. While that's still wet, just chuck a drop of the Fugan orange at the bottom of the panel. It'll automatically blend itself in if you do it right. While the Cassandori yellow is still wet, feather it into the yellow base coat that you've got. And then just highlights with like a very light, whiter yellow. So you can use your base yellow and then put some white in it and it'll do scratches and do the very just tops of the panels with that. That's half the battle. I mean, I find yellow, yeah, it's fine.
That's a good bit of advice, just the bit about spraying the yellow down first if you
absolutely.
Are able to do that. I'm curious about when you set out to do a diorama, do you sketch it out ahead of time? How do you plan? From once you get the concept in your head, how do you actually start a diorama?
Yeah, so I'll do a very rough sketch on to scale on grid paper, and I'll work out how big. So the first thing I'll always have is where is this thing going to go? You know, where am I going to put it? Because if you build something and then you've got nowhere to put it, where's it going? It's going to go in the garage,
right? That's so a really good point, man.
Yeah, that's the very first thing you need to do. So where is it going to go? Okay, I've got a meter, or I've got 60 centimeters, or I've got 30 inches, and I've got it's going to be in a bookshelf, so I've got 40 inches height. So then I'll get a sketch pad, a grid book, sorry, and measure it out. This is 40 inches high. This is 30 inches wide. This is the idea that I've got. Fit it into that thing and then juggle it around. Measure how, you know, get the picture right in scale and then measure it. So, all right, so in real life, that's going, you know, the top of that building is going to sit. It's going to look right if it sits 2 inches from the top and there's a bit of open sky or there's a bit of pipe hanging down or whatever. After that, I'll sometimes, if it's really going to be big, like the one that I'm doing now is pretty big. It's probably the most challenging one I've done, and I've got just bits of cardboard and cut them out the height and rough shape that I wanted. It takes like 5 minutes, and just sort of move them around. And that's where you start, get the big stuff right. After that, if you've got something like a Titan or a Knight or a big tank or something that you want to fit in it, leave the cardboard there, have the base where you want it, so it's just a piece of paper on the ground, and put the big model that you want in it. And you know, you've got to build that first,
right?
And then go through, build all the models, paint all the models. Once they're all built, you can then work out the structure. So until you've got everything that you want to put in it, you can't finish everything. You know, if you know that these guys are coming down a slope of rubble, you can't build that rubble pile until you know where all of those dudes' feet are. So you know how big they want to be and where their guns are pointing and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And then once you've got everything built, you can then finish the model.
Nice. That's a really good, the idea of using maquettes almost, you know, you're just mocking mock-ups, right? To just get your initial size. That's a good piece of advice. That's definitely something I would just not do. I'd be like, oh, I built this and it doesn't fit. Oh boy.
Well, the first one that I did, this big Space Wolf one that was what, 1 point something meters tall, that was just an absolute nightmare because that was just fly by the seat of my pants. Yeah, it'll be this high and that high, and then I got to the top and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna cut all this stuff off.
There's definitely like a post you have in there somewhere where you were like, it's 1 meter tall and growing.
Yeah,
so you definitely hadn't measured that one out yet, right? But
no, I hadn't done anything. Yeah, I did nothing with that, and I learned
right.
That's not the way to do it.
That was learning the lesson, and now you've gotten you adapt. Now you're like, okay,
have a plan.
All right, so this one's kind of a loaded question, but just kind of give it a shot. I'm really more interested in your philosophy on this than anything super specific, but how do you think someone who's maybe new to this, or someone who has never maybe even picked up a paintbrush, but they've always wanted to, you know, like they like the idea of the models and they just haven't done any painting and they don't feel like they have any talent or they don't feel like they could do a good job, so they never try. How do you think people could get into this and maybe work towards getting to your level of artistic composition? Do you have any advice on... Not even advice. I'm just curious about what you think about people getting into doing some kind of art when they're, you know, when they're initially thinking there's just no way, right? Like, I don't have any artistic talent. I can't draw a stick figure. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay. So the big thing is if you want to do it, then you're going to do it. So we assume that they want to do it. If you just assume that that people want to do it, the act of making anything, that comes, you can break it into two departments, if you will. Creativity, which is the stuff that goes on in your head, the stuff that you think of that's purely your own, that's, you know, it's influenced by other people, but it's yours, you know, colors or composition or whatever, any idea you've got. And then skill, which is just purely how you realize that creativity, your hand-eye coordination. It's sending that idea to a sculpture or a piece of paper or a model or anything. So there's that creativity side of it. You can nurture by reading books, like I said, you know, go on Instagram or Pinterest. But the skill side of it, really, you need to do it every day. Just do it every day, even if it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Your muscle will learn how much pressure you need to put on a brush to get a small line, a thick line, a thin line, the consistency of the paint. If you do it even just for 10 minutes, and the longer the better, obviously, but no one's got all the time in the world. Just if you do something every day, your body will take over. It will remember when you pick up that brush, even if it's in 6 months' time, it will remember, maybe not perfectly, but it will remember how to do these things. So the more you do something, the more it will become something that you don't have to think about. And once you stop thinking about can I paint that eyeball, or can I make, you know, a straight line or a freehand thing, it really frees you up. You go, well, yeah, I can do that. So what else can I do? What do I need to do? So every model or everything I paint, I'll generally try one thing that I've never done before. It might be a pigment, it might be OSL. OSL is something I haven't really done much of. It might be, a freehand thing that I've never drawn before. Just anything. Just pick, it doesn't matter what it is. Just pick something you haven't done and do it. Once your muscles are doing everything you want them to do and you've got lots of ideas that you are able to then, focus into a model, the rest just sort of goes exponentially. If you can practice and just do it every day and still enjoy it, then that's the key.
Nice, man. That's cool. And I actually wanted to comment on something you said earlier, which I thought was actually a pretty wonderful note to make. And it was, we were talking about painting the checks, and you said that when you're painting those little checks in there, or those lines, like, don't concentrate on the actual, like, don't concentrate too hard on that, what you're doing right there.
Yep.
Just sort of let your relax a little bit and I found that to be very important. It's like the more, like, if I'm going in to paint some eyeballs or whatever, and I'm like, the more I focus and the more I like stress about it, it's like the shakier my hand will get. But if you just like relax a little bit, and just don't think of it quite, don't stare at it too hard, you can kind of relax a little bit and your muscles can kind of take over. I think that was it's a pretty wonderful
muscle
concept.
Memory.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. If you're carrying a big tray of drinks or a pile of food or something, if you start thinking about every step you take and where your hands are and is the plate flat,
right,
that thing going on the ground 100%.
Yeah, exactly. I've been there. That's, yes.
Yeah. Everyone's been there. Everyone's been there. Yeah. And it's the same with like with painting or art or anything.
Sure. All right, man. So I think just two last little questions here. One is kind of facetious. When do you think you're going to release your coffee table book?
Coffee table book. I don't know.
All right.
Maybe.
Soon, right? Come on. Yeah.
I've thought of it. I've thought of getting like a book made up. You can do those things online, I think.
Sure.
I haven't looked into it too much. But yeah, it's actually something that I have thought about doing.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've got one sale right here, and I'm sure you'd have more soon. But yeah, I mean, it's doing a book like that is not a, I say that facetiously, but it is actually a very simple thing to do, And because everything can be print on demand, you don't really have to put out any. It's time for you to design the book and design the pages, digitally. But actually, to get it printed, it's just print on demand, right? Somebody wants to order it, they order it, and then it'll get printed and sent out to them. So,
I could totally do it. I think I probably will. I'd be looking at possibly having like an exhibition of my stuff at the end of next year. And
Nice.
if I do get that off the ground, then I will, then I will put together, a book or something.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Very cool. Wow. An exhibition next year. So when you say an exhibition, what does that entail?
So it would be, this piece that I'm working on now is 60 centimeters wide. I don't know what that is in inches, sorry, off the top of my head. But it's, it's 60 centimeters wide. I've got a 45 centimeter depth of my area that I want to display it on. And it's 95 centimeters tall, which is nearly a meter tall. And I have got the 60 centimeter piece, which is the first piece, then basically straight after I finish this, the next piece is built, which is starting to be built, which is another 60 centimeters. I've got 1.8 meters of width to play with. I'm going to build essentially a city.
Wow. So you're going to,
and that's the plan.
And you're going to be able to, so you're putting these, this will be some sort of installation in like a gallery or somewhere where people can go to see it.
That's the bit that I don't know. I need to speak to a few things that I can't talk about, but
sure.
I've got a few things that I have to ask about. But yeah, that's the hardest part, is finding the right place to put it. Obviously nothing, it's not for sale. I'm not going to sell it. It's really just come and have a look. And if I do that, if that does get off the ground, then yeah, I think I would put together a book with a bit of lore, a bit of background that I've sort of written about the setting. That would be, I think, a cool thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That sounds fantastic. That's very cool. Right on, dude. Okay, so last question, And what it could be, whatever you want, whatever your answer is, we'll take it. what is your one piece of advice you would give anybody out there, just for what's your life philosophy or your one piece of advice on getting through life? That's a small question, right? It's small,
yeah,
it's tiny.
Okay, so I think what's worked for me, say yes. Just say yes. If you can't do something and you think you can probably do it, if you gave it a go, just do it. You know, if someone comes to you and says, oh, can you do this job? Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, unless they're saying, you know, unless the job is to, like, I don't know, abseil down a building and rescue right. some hostages, then yeah, just say yes.
Right.
And just see what happens.
You know? Dude, that's positive. A good one. That's a good one, man. Just say yes. Wow. I like that. Dude. So, this was a wonderful conversation, dude. I thank you again for taking the time. There's a whole bunch of other questions I have for you, but maybe I can hit you up again in a year when you're getting ready to do your show or your display and we'll talk some more.
Absolutely.
Super cool,
my
man.
Pleasure.
All right, dude. Well, thank you so much. Your work is stupendous. It's wonderful. I love looking at your feed and, man, best of luck with your future projects.
Thank you so much. And, best of luck with, the podcast.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. All right, dude. Have a great
pleasure.
Day. Okay, man.
You too. You too.
Dude, thank you again, sir, for taking time out from your busy maritime schedule to hang out and chat. And as always, everyone can find links to Jeremy's Instagram in the show notes at crimo.com. What a great conversation. What a cool dude, right? Good luck with the kids, man, and the mermaids. And I didn't say it during the interview, but I just hope he's got some kind of cutlass underneath that yacht steering wheel or whatever, you know, because he's one of our best bets for a real life swashbuckler, right? Okay, definitely check out the show notes for links to some of the things he mentions in the show and to see a few select photos from his Instagram feed. And I'll try to remember to check back in at some point next year to find out where and when his art showing will happen and how we can all get our hands on his coffee table art book when it comes out. See, it's been advertised. Now he's got no choice. He's got to do it. All right, time for some hobby progress. Well, this week has been a little bit slow on the hobby side of things. Cue embarrassed voice here. I played quite a bit of Skyrim for no real reason at all, and I even opened up Minecraft for an hour or two. And yes, I'm cringing as I say all this. I'm doing it to keep myself honest. I'm trying to navigate this, whatever's in my head that is working desperately to get me to sit on my ass without being productive. So part of this podcast, of course, is just me trying to psych myself out, but you know. Also, there was that music video and a commercial shoot for some lawyers, so those definitely impacted my working time. To be honest, I probably will not finish any of the three models I am currently working on this week, those being the Biker Scout from Star Wars Legion, and the really awesome figure from the Bushido game, and the Dragonkin Sorcerer from Reaper Minis. I will say this so far, I'm hating my work on the Speeder Bike Scout, I'm pretty happy with the main color on the Samurai Woman's dress, and I'm very happy with the skin tone on the Dragonkin figure. Kira is helping me with color choices on the Bushido figure, and she requested that the main dress color be Lego Sand Green, which is a wonderful color, but I had to custom mix it, and I think whether or not I got it close is probably irrelevant, because in the end, I think it's looking pretty good. Anyway, I'll be working on these more throughout the next week, so we'll see how it goes. Let's take a peek at Section Charlie. Section Charlie, where I get to highlight someone or something I found online that I think is too cool for school. That never, ever, never sounds not cheesy. Too cool for school. When did that even saying come out? Like in the 50s? All right, so this episode, I'm using my platform here to promote a non-hobby related Section Charlie thing here. Yeah, I know, it's kind of a sneaky thing to do, but I was very impressed with this short film that I watched on YouTube. It's only 4 minutes long, 5 minutes running time, but that's with a minute of credits. I'm sure it's going to win all kinds of awards. I mean, I think it's already started doing that sort of thing. It really is an extremely well-made short film, and it's kind of startling in its subject matter. And it's well-made on a story level because from the first frame to the last, it will keep you hooked. At least it did for me and everyone I've linked it to so far. So give it a shot. It's called Nursery Rhymes, and make sure you watch at least the first 30 to 60 seconds, And I think you'll be hooked to the end, which again is only, you know, it's only 3 to 4. It's only like, you know, 4 minutes long, the actual story part of it. I can't really say anything else about it. And to be honest, I wish the title of it on YouTube didn't include the descriptor. If you can, try not to read the full title. This is kind of lame, but because it gives away a particular technical detail, this won't ruin the short at all. But it would just be cooler to see it the first time, not knowing about this technical detail up front. But it's almost impossible not to notice that because it's literally in the title of when you see the link. Also, the short film is an Australian production. So there, we stayed down under for the whole episode. All right, well, check it out if you get a chance. The link will be in the show notes. You probably don't want your 12-year-olds, you know, nephews or kids to watch it, maybe. It's not super adult or anything, or I don't want to give anything away, but I think pretty much anybody can watch it who's above probably a certain age, you know. So, you know, I'd say it's probably PG-13 rated, I suppose, if there were ratings for short films. Anyway, yeah, check it out. Let me know what you think if you watch it. You know, I thought it definitely sticks in your mind for a while afterwards. All right, that puts a marshmallow in this s'more. Smash that chocolate and graham cracker and go to work. I hope you all have a lovely week. I hope you close some of that distance between you and your goals. Always remember to take it easy. One step at a time is how all those nuts climbed Mount Everest. Yeah. And I'll be drumming up more interviews for more hobby listening pleasure, motivation, and time passing. Take care. Tell someone you love that you love them. And I will see ya.